Now here's what the Wheeler case reads, the Wheeler v. Scott. The question is whether after summary judgment was entered against Robert L. Scott, the appellant client, in a mortgage foreclosure procedure, and after the trial court subsequently reduced the fee charged by Scott's attorney from $140,116.87 to $125,723, the fee was still excessive. After careful examination, the court found that it was. And here are the facts of the case. Robert L. Scott, the client appellant, a geologist and geophysicist, hired Robert L. Wheeler, the appellee lawyer, to represent him after he was unable to pay a business loan. During the next 10 months, Wheeler represented Scott in the collection and lien foreclosure action filed against Scott by the mortgagee, United Oklahoma Bank. In the first 5 months of Wheeler's representation, Scott was billed for legal services in the amount of $54,275.37, representing 524 and a half hours and averaging 108 and a half hours per month, which he did pay. During the next 5 months, Scott was billed $85,841.50 for legal services, represented $753.4 hours, averaging 150.6 hours per month, which he did not pay. The bank then moved for summary judgment. 2 days before the hearing on the bank's motion, the lawyer told his client that if the attorney fees were not paid, he would withdraw from the case. Scott did not pay, and Wheeler did not withdraw. Instead, a first-year associate was sent to oppose the bank's motion for summary judgment. The bank's motion was granted, and the attorney withdrew from the case. Thereafter, Scott retained new counsel, and the case was settled. Wheeler then filed an action to collect unpaid attorney's fees. Scott answered, asserting that the fees were excessive for the following reasons. 1. The case was never tried. Summary judgment was entered against him. 2. The client was billed a total of $1,295.9 hours. However, a first-year associate who had failed to pass the bar at the first sitting and who had been admitted to the bar only 5 months before beginning work on the case billed 853 and a half hours at $110 an hour. The firm representing the bank charged the bank $75,534.10 for 850 hours. These hours were for three attorneys with an average of 10 to 20 years of experience who normally bill at $150 an hour. However, because the lawyers are on retainer with the bank, they reduced their normally hourly rate on this case. 4. The bank's motion for summary judgment alleged that although a large amount of money and property was involved, the foreclosure was a simple case complicated by unfounded and legally unsound assertions by Scott's counsel. The bank's lawyer repeated these assertions at the hearing on attorney's fees, and he also testified that his first year's associates were billed at $85 an hour. As prevailing party, the opposing attorney received $75,534.10 in attorney's fees. After hearing the evidence, the trial court reduced the hourly rate of the first-year associates from $110 to $80 an hour, and the total attorney's fees from $140,116.87 to $125,723. Scott appealed. The Court of Appeals affirmed. We grant certiorari to address the question of the reasonableness of attorney's fees. A proper resolution of this case requires a thorough examination and balancing of the 12 factors below. Number 1, the time and labor required. The most visible and the most readily explainable portion of a bill for attorney's fees is the time and labor expended by an attorney in performing services for a client. However, it is not the only relevant factor, and it must be considered in conjunction with the other enumerated criteria. Fees cannot be awarded on the basis of time alone. The use of time as the sole standard of is of dubious value, where fees to be calculated based only on the time spent on a case, where the use of time would cease to be a virtue and premium would be placed on inexperience, inefficiency, and inability, and expeditious disposition of litigation would go unrewarded. The time spent in acquiring a basic law school education in the areas of law concern cannot be regarded as one of the determinative factors of a reasonable attorney fee. Attorneys are presumed to have acquired a working knowledge of fundamental legal practices, as well as the ability to examine and apply the law. This does not mean that an attorney within the limitations ordinarily necessary for the competent and skillful lawyer should not be compensated for the time spent in necessary research. It does not mean that if a lawyer takes on a case in an area in which he or she is totally unfamiliar or inexperienced, the client should not have to pay for every minute of the lawyer's preparation. Here, for example, a comparison of the time charged for preparation of the case by each of the law firms reflects that it is unlikely that billing 1,295.9 billable hours, 853.5 of which were by a first-year lawyer, was proper when the prevailing law firm staffed by seasoned counsel charged for 850 hours. In short, a reasonable attorney's fees in a given case does not necessarily result from a simple multiplication of the hours spent times a fixed hourly rate. Another factor, number two, is the novelty or difficulty of issues. The attorney for the prevailing party testified at the hearing, and he stated in his motion for summary judgment that this was a simple case. He also noted that although a large sum of the money was involved, the case had been unduly complicated by opposing counsel's unfounded and legally unsound assertions. One of the basic considerations in establishing the reasonable value of legal services is the type, extent, and difficulty of the services rendered. Substance must control over form. The intricacies and difficulty of the questions involved, and not necessarily the amount of manual legal work exhibited by the number of papers in the file of the case, must control. Number three, the skill requisite to perform. Another factor which must be considered with the novelty or difficulty of the issue is whether the services are routine or whether exceptional skill or effort is required. Wheeler testified that he relied on his oil and gas expertise in designing his strategy. However, this expertise apparently did not come into play before summary judgment was entered because the attorney did not determine the value of the oil-producing properties until after it was rendered. The declining value of the properties was the reason given by the bank for settling the cause for less than the amount entered in its favor on summary judgment. Number four, the loss of opportunity for other employment. The fact that employment for which compensation is sought deprived the attorney of the opportunity to secure other employment is another element of sub-significance in determining reasonable fee. The court must consider not only the loss of other employment because of the time taken by the matter at hand, but also the fact that there may be involved in the matter certain elements which might cause the attorney to lose future business because of an association with the case. The attorney testified that this case neither required that he refused to represent a potential client, nor did he introduce any evidence that his association with the case deprived him of future business. Number five, customary fee. Generally, courts consider the amounts customarily charged or allowed for similar services in the same locality. Only two witnesses were presented, and their testimony was conflicting. The expert called by Scott testified the amount the prevailing party received, $75,500, was reasonable compensation. The expert witness who testified on behalf of Wheeler stated that $140,000 was a reasonable fee. Whether the fee is fixed or contingent. Although the court initially looks to the hourly rate for comparable representation, where the compensation is contingent by assessing the likelihood of success at the outset of the representation, although contingent fees contracts are subject to restrictions, especially if the client is a minor, such agreements have generally been enforced unless the contract is unreasonable. The contingent fee system allows persons who cannot otherwise afford to assert their claims to have their day in court. In this case, a contingent fee is not involved. The parties agreed that the fee would be based on an hourly rate. Number seven, time limitations imposed by the client or circumstance. This element is pertinent if an attorney must adjust the firm's other workload to accommodate the particular pressing needs of the client. Generally, additional fees have been allowed when the client failed timely to notify the attorney of such problems. There is no evidence implying any unusual time restrictions. Number eight, the amount involved and the results obtained. In establishing reasonable attorney's fees, the courts may properly consider the amount involved in litigation. This case involved over $10 million. However, this cannot be the sole component to be weighed, and the amount implicated, even though large in denomination, neither increases measurability of the work nor enlarges the principles of law. It cannot be a deciding factor in setting a very high fee. Closely related to the element of the amount of value or the property at issue, it is the solution achieved by the attorney. While the court could consider all guidelines, it must also contemplate the benefit to the client as a result of the services. The attorney testified that his client needed what he provided for the time for opportunity to accomplish settlement, either to extend the client's loan or to make arrangements to fit his cash flow and current financial condition. We note that after the attorney withdrew, the client and the bank settled. Number 9, experience, reputation, and ability of the attorney. The attorney's standing in the profession for learning, ability, skill, and integrity is recognized as a proper matter for consideration and assessing the value of services provided and can be a basis for a higher award. The reverse is also true. Inexperience, apparent lack of ability, or the poor performance may reduce the award. Here it appears from the timesheets and the appearances in court that the primary attorney was the first-year associate. The testimony by the expert witness indicated that the first-year associate had not established a reputation in the legal community sufficient to command a higher fee. The undesirability of the case. Apparently, this was an ordinary case to foreclose a lien which the client had little chance of winning, and that the client's best solution was the settlement obtained after the attorney withdrew from the case. 11. Casual or regular employment. The nature and length of the professional relationship between the client and the attorney is also subject to review. Clients who do not routinely employ the attorney should not expect the lower legal fees normally negotiated with clients who regularly hire or retain counsel. Scott was not a regular client. 12. Awards in similar cases. There is no evidence presented concerning awards in similar cases other than the amount received by the prevailing party. So, in conclusion, the proper determination of reasonable attorney fees requires a balancing and thorough consideration of the 12 factors just discussed. Apparently, the trial court gave too much weight to the time spent on the case and failed to consider adequately the other applicable standards. Setting attorney fees would be a simple matter if numbers could be inserted mechanically into a universally valid formula. Unfortunately, this is not the case. Here, it is obvious that much of the time expended was unnecessary by any reasonable standard. Under our detailed analysis of the guidelines, particularly the excessive time spent, the relative simplicity of the issues, except where they were needlessly multiplied and complicated by the counsel, the very average lawyering skill required, the non-preclusion of other employment, and the entry of summary judgment, the customary fee, the absence of restrictive time limitations, and the inexperience of lawyers who did the bulk of the work, we find that the fee allowed by the trial court is excessive, reversed and remanded with directions. Let's shift gears now, and we're going to discuss confidential information. And as before, we'll discuss the ABA model rules and then jump into some case law with regards to confidential information. So what ABA model rules are covered here? Well, the first one is Rule 1.2D, the scope of representation and allocation of authority between client and lawyer. And 1.2D states, a lawyer shall not counsel a client to engage or assist a client in conduct that the lawyer knows is criminal or fraudulent, but a lawyer may discuss the legal consequences of any proposed course of conduct with a client and may counsel or assist a client to make a good faith effort to determine the validity, scope, meaning, or application of the law. And what's important too is the comments here, comment 10, which states under criminal fraudulent prohibited transactions, comment 10, when the client's course of action has already begun and is continuing, the lawyer's responsibility is especially delicate. The lawyer is required to avoid assisting the client, for example, by drafting or delivering documents that the lawyer knows are fraudulent or by suggesting how the wrongdoing might be concealed. A lawyer may not continue assisting a client in conduct that the lawyer originally supposed was legally proper, but then discovers is criminal or fraudulent. The lawyer must, therefore, withdraw from the representation of the client in the matter. In some cases, withdrawal alone might be insufficient. It may be necessary for the lawyer to give notice of the fact of withdrawal and to disaffirm any opinion, document, affirmation, or the like. Now, ABA Model Rule 1.6 confidentiality of information, which states, a lawyer shall not reveal information relating to the representation of a client unless the client gives informed consent to disclosure. The disclosure is impliedly authorized in order to carry out the representation, or disclosure is permitted by paragraph B. B. A lawyer may reveal information relating to the representation of a client to the extent the lawyer reasonably believes necessary to prevent reasonable certain death or substantial bodily harm, to prevent the client from committing a crime of fraud that is reasonably certain to result in substantial injury to the financial interests or property of another, and in furtherance of the client has used or is using the lawyer's services, to prevent, mitigate, or rectify substantial injury to the financial interests or property of another that is reasonably certain to result or has resulted from the client's commission of a crime or fraud in furtherance of which the client has used the lawyer's services, or to secure legal advice about the lawyer's compliance in which these rules, to establish a claim defense on behalf of the lawyer in controversy between the lawyer and the client, to establish a defense to a criminal charge or civil claim against a lawyer based upon conduct in which the client was involved, or to respond to allegations in any proceeding concerning the lawyer's representation of the client, to comply with other law or court order, or to detect and resolve conflicts of interest arising from the lawyer's change of employment or from changes in the composition or ownership of a firm, but only if the revealed information would not compromise the attorney-client privilege or otherwise prejudice the client. Finally, a lawyer shall make reasonable efforts to prevent the inadvertent or unauthorized disclosure or unauthorized access to information relating to the representation of a client. Rule 1.8B, or Rule 1.8, Conflicts of Interest, Current Clients, what B states, a lawyer shall not use information related to representation of a client to the disadvantage of a client unless the client gives informed consent, except as permitted or required by these rules. Rule 1.9, Duties to Former Clients, specifically Rule 1.9B, which states, a lawyer shall not knowingly represent a person in the same or a substantially related matter in which a firm with which the lawyer formerly was associated had previously represented a client whose interests are materially adverse to that person and about whom the lawyer had acquired information protected by Rules 1.6 and 1.9C that is material to the matter unless the former client gives informed consent confirmed in writing. Rule 3.3, Candor toward the Tribunal. A lawyer shall not knowingly make a false statement of fact or law to a tribunal or fail to correct a false statement of material fact or law previously made to the tribunal by the lawyer. Fail to disclose to the tribunal legal authority in the controlling jurisdiction known to the lawyer to be directly adverse to the position of the client and not disclosed by the opposing counsel, or offer evidence that the lawyer knows to be false. If a lawyer, the lawyer's client, or a witness called by the lawyer has offered material evidence and the lawyer comes to know of its falsity, the lawyer shall take reasonable remedial measures, including, if necessary, disclosure to the tribunal. A lawyer may refuse to offer evidence other than the testimony of a defendant in a criminal matter and the lawyer reasonably believes is false. A lawyer who represents a client in an adjudicative proceeding and who knows that a person intends to engage, is engaging, or has engaged in criminal or fraudulent conduct related to the proceeding shall take reasonable remedial measures, including, if necessary, disclosure to the tribunal. The duties stated in paragraphs A and B continue to the conclusion of the proceeding and apply even if compliance rules disclosure of information otherwise protected by Rule 1.6. In an ex parte proceeding, a lawyer shall inform the tribunal of all material facts known to the lawyer that will enable the tribunal to make an informed decision whether or not the facts are adverse. ABA Model Rule 3.4, Fairness to Opposing Partner and Counsel, specifically Rule 3.4A, which states a lawyer shall not unlawfully obstruct another party's access to evidence or unlawfully alter, destroy, conceal a document or other material having potential evidentiary value. A lawyer shall not conceal or assist another person to do any such act. Finally, Rule 4.1 of the ABA Model Rules, Truthfulness in Statements to Others. In the course of representing a client, a lawyer shall not knowingly make a false statement of material fact or law to a third person or fail to disclose a material fact to a third person when the disclosure is necessary to avoid assisting a criminal or fraudulent act by a client, unless disclosure is prohibited by Rule 1.6. One of our first cases with regards to confidential information is Washington v. Olwell. This is the Supreme Court of the State of Washington, 1964. And the issue here is, may an attorney refuse to produce at a coroner's inquest material evidence of a crime by asserting the attorney-client privilege or by claiming the privilege against self-incrimination on behalf of his client? The attorney's refusal to testify and produce the evidence in his possession was not contemptuous. To be protected as a privileged communication, information or objects acquired by attorney must have been communicated or delivered to him by the client and not merely obtained by the attorney while acting in the capacity of the client, for the client. Our next case is People v. Meredith. This is the Supreme Court of California 1981 case. And what happened here is defendant Frank Earl Scott was convicted of first-degree murder. A crucial component of the prosecution's case was the location of the victim's wallet. The location of the wallet was revealed by defendant Scott in his attorney as he seeks to have such communication protected as privilege. So what's the rule here? The attorney-client privilege allows certain disclosures of information reasonably necessary to accomplish the purpose for which the attorney was hired. The facts of the case, Frank Earl Scott and Michael Meredith, defendants, were convicted of first-degree murder. They robbed, shot, and killed David Wade. Defendant Scott's conviction is dependent on the theory that he conspired with the defendant Meredith and a third defendant. The prosecution sought to introduce the location of the victim's wallet, which was found in a barrel behind defendant Scott's house. Defendant Scott revealed the location of the wallet to his attorney. His attorney hired an investigator who retrieved the wallet, and it was eventually turned over to police. Defendant Scott's attorney was forced to testify that his client revealed the location of the wallet. Defendant Scott appeals, arguing that the communication should have been privileged. And so the issue here, does the attorney-client privilege protect facts observed as a direct result of confidential communication if the defense removed or altered evidence preventing the prosecution from discovering the evidence? Well, the justice has held for the Supreme Court of California that the defense counsel removes or alters evidence, the attorney-client privilege does not bar revealing the original condition or location of the evidence. So the attorney client privilege allows certain disclosures of information reasonably necessary to accomplish the purpose for which the attorney was hired. The court notes that the defense left the wallet and merely observed its location. Then the observations would not have to be revealed because they were derived from privileged communication. I know I went over a rule earlier, but there are exceptions to the confidentiality under Rule 1.6b, when a lawyer may reveal information related to the representation of a client to extent the lawyer reasonably believes necessary. And some of these exceptions are to prevent reasonable certain death or substantial bodily harm, to prevent the client from committing a crime or fraud that is reasonably certain to result in substantial injury to the financial interests of property of another and in furtherance of which the client has used or is using the lawyer's services, to prevent, mitigate, or rectify substantial injury to the financial interests or property of another that is reasonably certain to result or has resulted from the client's commission of a crime or fraud in furtherance of which the client has used the lawyer's services, or to secure legal advice about the lawyer's compliance with these rules, to establish or claim defense on behalf of the lawyer in a controversy between the lawyer and the client, to establish a defense to a criminal charge or a civil claim against the lawyer based upon conduct in which the client was involved or responds to allegations in any proceeding concerning the lawyer's representation of a client. Moving along here, now we're going to cover bias. And some of the ABA model rules which are covered here are 1.8J, 3.4, 3.5, 4.4, and 8.4. So 1.8J discusses a lawyer shall not have sexual relations with a client unless a consensual sexual relationship existed between them when the client-lawyer relationship commenced. Rule 3.4 discusses fairness to opposing party and counsel. A lawyer shall not unlawfully obstruct another party's access to evidence or unlawfully alter, destroy, and conceal document or other material having potential evidentiary value. A lawyer shall not counsel or assist another person to do any such act, falsify evidence, counsel or assist a witness to testify, falsify, or offer an inducement to a witness that is prohibited by law, knowingly disobey an obligation under the rules of a tribunal except for an open refusal based on an assertion that no valid obligation exists, in a pretrial procedure, make a frivolous discovery request, or fail to make reasonable, diligent efforts to comply with a legally proper discovery request by an opposing party. In trial, allude to any matter that the lawyer does not reasonably believe is relevant or that will not be supported by admissible evidence. Assert personal knowledge of facts in issue except when testifying as a witness, or state a personal opinion as to the justness of a cause, the credibility of a witness, the culpability of a civil litigant, or the guilt of innocence of the accused, or request a person other than a client to refrain from voluntarily giving relevant information to another party unless the person is a relative or an employee of a or other agent of a client and the lawyer reasonably believes that the person's interests will not be adversely affected by refraining from giving such information. ABA Model Rule 3.5, Impartiality and Decorum of the Tribunal. A lawyer shall not seek to influence a judge, juror, prospective juror, or other official by means prohibited by law. Communicate ex parte with such a person during the proceeding unless authorized to do so by law or court order. Communicate with a juror, prospective juror, after discharge of a jury if the communication is prohibited by law or court order. The juror has made known to the lawyer a desire not to be communicated with, or the communication involves misrepresentation, coercion, duress, or harassment, or engage in conduct intended to disrupt a tribunal. ABA Model Rule 4.4, Respect for Rights of Third Persons. In representing a client, a lawyer shall not use means that have no substantial purpose other than to embarrass, delay, or burden a third person, or use methods of obtaining evidence that violate the legal rights of such a person. A lawyer who receives a document or electronically stored information relating to the representation of the lawyer's client and knows of or reasonably should know that the document or electronically stored information was inadvertently sent shall promptly notify the sender. And then finally, Rule 8.4, the misconduct rule again. It is professional misconduct, and this is a very important rule. That's why we're going over it again. It is professional misconduct for a lawyer to violate or attempt to violate the rules of professional conduct, knowingly assist or induce another to do so, or do so through the acts of another. Commit a criminal act that reflects adversely on the lawyer's honesty, trustworthiness, or fitness as a lawyer in other respects. Engage in conduct involving dishonesty, fraud, deceit, or misrepresentation. Engage in conduct that is prejudicial to the administration of justice. State or imply an ability to influence improperly a government agency or official, or to achieve results by means that violate the rules of professional conduct or other law. Knowingly assist a judge or judicial officer in conduct that is a violation of applicable rules of judicial conduct or other law, or engage in conduct that the lawyer knows or reasonably should know is harassment or discrimination on the basis of race, sex, religion, national origin, ethnicity, disability, age, sexual orientation, gender identity, marital status, or socioeconomic status, and conduct related to the practice of law. This paragraph does not limit the ability of a lawyer to accept, decline, or withdraw from a representation in accordance with Rule 1.16. This paragraph does not preclude legitimate advice or advocacy consistent with these rules. The first bias case we're going to go over is In Re Plaza Hotel Corporation. This is United States Bankruptcy Court, 1990. In this case, the bankruptcy court granted a motion to disqualify the debtor's counsel for several reasons, including a conflict of interest and unacceptable gender bias behavior toward the trustee's female counsel. Of greater concern to the court is the gender's bias that the counsel has exhibited towards women who represent the Chapter 11 trustee and the United States trustee in this court. Counsel, in the course of this proceeding and in writing, referred to the women who represent the United States trustees as office help, even though he knew that she was a lawyer. He refused to respond to her written request for fuller disclosure of his apparent conflict of interest, which she has signed as designee of the United States trustee. He reasoned that he need not respond because she decided that she knew more than the court and that her job title was not sufficiently exalted. The condescending attitude towards the United States trustee's lawyer that counsel evinced during the hearing gave gender-biased content and context to those remarks. They would not have been made but for the fact that the lawyer in question is female. Gender-biased remarks are unworthy of counsels who appear in federal court, interfere with the orderly conduct of federal litigation in an atmosphere of equal justice, and are sanctionable as the casting of racial or ethnic epithets and slurs among counsel. They merit, at minimum, rebuke. In this instance, they are indicative of debtor's counsel's unwillingness to assist the debtor in discharging his duties to cooperate with the Chapter 11 trustee and the United States trustee. This court is greatly disappointed that a lawyer would think that it would broke such remarks and arguments sounding in gender bias. All counsel appearing in this court need to understand that such offensive remarks will be dealt with forcefully. He will be disqualified from representing the debtor. Another bias case is in re Vincenti. This is the Supreme Court of New Jersey 1998 case. The Supreme Court of New Jersey ordered the respondent disbarred, noting that at some point a court is forced to conclude that it can no longer expose judges, lawyers, litigants, witnesses, and the public to inexcusable conduct or of a renegade attorney. We've passed that point. The only appropriate sanction for respondent's misconduct is disbarment. Respondent's behaviors included harassment and intimidation on the basis of sexual orientation. The Division of Youth and Family Services, the DYFS, filed a petition in Superior Court to terminate the parental rights of JD, the natural mother of ARS. James Valente was appointed and served as law guardian for the child, ARS. One of the witnesses called by the Division of Youth and Family Services was a social worker. At the request of James Valente, law guardian for ARS, the social worker conducted a bonding evaluation to address the issues of where ARS should reside permanently. The social worker, too, was a victim of harassment and intimidation by respondent. At the ethics hearing, the social worker testified as follows about respondent's courtroom behavior. The thrust of his questions, as I experienced them, had less to do with the content than with an attempt to demean me, to ridicule me. I felt the nature of his cross-examination was highly personalized and had very little to do with the content or with trying to uncover the truth for the issues. For example, in the voir dire, he took a tremendous amount of time asking me what specific courses I had taken when I was in graduate school. At the time that I testified, it had been 15 years since I completed my doctorate and over 20 years since I completed my master's degree. He wanted to know the specific names of the courses I had taken. I said I couldn't remember the specific names, that I could talk about the kinds of courses I took and how they related to the coursework I was doing. He ridiculed me for the fact that I could not remember the course name and went over that over and over again. Respondents also made insinuations about the social worker's sexual orientation. He suggested that she inappropriately touches client JD during a bonding evaluation session with JD and ARS. Respondent attached significance to the fact that the social worker used purple paper for taking notes in her office, despite her explanation that it was the easiest color for her eyes. Respondent even said that he would bring in an expert to talk about the meaning of using purple paper. Respondent also used sashaying and other bodily language to question her sexuality, as a social worker testified at the ethics hearing. The court: did he imply what meaning he read into this? The witness: my view? The court: yes. The witness: given his body language, given that it came on the heels of his suggestion that I touched his client, that there was something about my sexual orientation that was revealed by the colors of the paper and the paper clip as well. That's why I mentioned the body language also, that on the heels of all this and the context within which it was raised, certainly the implications was that there was something about my sexual orientation that he was alluding to. The court: is that what came across to you? The witness: yes, absolutely, without question. In addition, respondent took the social worker's notes from her during her testimony. He then toyed with her, refusing to return the notes. When she asked the judge to instruct respondent to return the notes, respondent berated the judge for talking to the witnesses. Unfortunately for the social worker, the conclusion of the ARS trial did not signal the end to the respondent's harassment towards her. About 6 months after the trial ended, She and other witnesses who had testified in the ARS matter were invited to participate at a conference sponsored by the Association of Trial Lawyers of America. There was no connection between the trial and the conference. However, in a letter to Carrie B. Sheshvitz, the conference coordinator, respondent contended that the social worker held Nazi views and suggested that it would be helpful if respondent attended the conference to denounce them. Although the letter cannot be introduced into evidence because it was discarded after receiving it, the social worker testified at the ethics hearing about the contents of the letter while respondent complained that the letter was not produced. He did not deny having sent it. Our final topic of this course is conflicts of interest. And we'll go over some of the ABA model rules, then get into some case law. And the model rules that are implicated here are Rule 1.2, 1.7, 1.8, 1.10, 1.13, 1.14, 1.18, 2.1, 3.7, and 5.4C. Won't go over all of those, but I do want to highlight some of them. With regards to Rule 1.7, conflicts of interest and current clients, except as provided in paragraph B, a lawyer shall not represent a client if the representation involves a concurrent conflict of interest. A concurrent conflict of interest exists if the representation of one client will be directly adverse to another client, or there is a significant risk that the representation of one or more clients will be materially limited by the lawyer's responsibilities to another client, a former client, or a third person, or by a personal interest of the lawyer. Notwithstanding the existence of a concurrent conflict of interest, under paragraph A, a lawyer may represent a client if the lawyer reasonably believes that the lawyer will be able to provide competent and diligent representation to each affected client. The representation is not prohibited by law. The representation does not involve the assertion of a claim by one client against another client represented by the lawyer in the same litigation or other proceedings before a tribunal, and each effective client gives informed consent confirmed in writing. And obviously, Rule 1.8, conflicts of interest, current clients, that's a very important rule. I won't read over that again. Rule 1.10, imputation of conflicts of interest. While lawyers are associated in a firm, none of them shall knowingly represent a client when any one of them practicing alone would be prohibited from doing so by Rules 1.7 or 1.9, unless prohibition is based on a personal interest of the disqualified lawyer and does not represent a significant risk of material limiting the representation of the client by the remaining lawyers in the firm, or the prohibition is based upon Rule 1.9A or B, and arises out of the disqualified lawyer's association with the prior firm, and the disqualified lawyer is timely screened from any participation in the matter and is portioned no part of the fee therefrom. Written notice is promptly given to any affected former clients to enable the former client to ascertain in compliance with the provisions of this rule, which shall include a description of the screening procedures employed, a statement of the firm's and the screened lawyer's compliance with these rules, a statement that the review may be available before a tribunal, and an agreement by the firm to respond promptly to any written inquiries or objections by the former client and about the screening procedures, and certifications of clients with these rules and with the screening procedures are provided to the former client by the screened lawyer and by the partner of the firm at reasonable intervals upon the former client's written request and upon termination of the screening procedures. When a lawyer has terminated an association with the firm is not prohibited from thereafter representing a person with interests material adverse to those of a client represented by the formerly associated lawyer and not currently represented by the firm unless the matter is the same or substantially related to that in which the formerly associated lawyer represented the clients, and any lawyer remaining in the firm has information protected by Rules 1.6 and 1.9 that is material to the matter. A disqualification prescribed by this rule may be waived by the affected client under conditions stated in Rule 1.7. Disqualification of the lawyers associated in a firm with the former or current government lawyers is governed by Rule 1.11. ABA Model Rule 1.13, organization as a client. As a lawyer employed or retained by an organization represents the organization acting through its duly authorized constituents, if a lawyer for an organization knows that an officer, employees, or other persons associated with the organization is engaged in action, intends to act, or refuses to act in a matter related to the representation that is in violation of a legal obligation to the organization or a violation of law that reasonably might be imputed to the organization and that is likely to result in substantial injury to the organization, then the lawyer shall proceed as is reasonably necessary to the best interests of the organization, unless the lawyer reasonably believes that that is not necessary to the best interests of the organization to do so. The lawyer shall refer to the matter to the higher authority in the organization, including, if warranted by the circumstances, of the highest authority that can be act on behalf of the organization, as is determined by applicable law. Except as provided in paragraph D, if, despite the lawyer's efforts in accordance with paragraph B, the highest authority that can act on behalf of an organization insists upon or fails to address in a timely and appropriate manner an action or refusal to act that is clearly a violation of law, and the lawyer reasonably believes that the violation is reasonably certain to result in substantial injury to the organization, then the lawyer may reveal information relating to the representation whether or not Rule 1.6 permits such disclosures, but only if and to the extent the lawyer reasonably believes necessary to prevent substantial injury to the organization. Paragraph C shall not apply with respect to information relating to a lawyer's representation of an organization to investigate an alleged violation of law or to defend the organization or an officer, employee, or other constituents associated with the organization against a claim arising out of the alleged violation of law. A lawyer who reasonably believes that he or she has been discharged because of the lawyer's actions taken pursuant to paragraphs B or C, or who withdraws under circumstances that require or permit the lawyer to take action under either of these paragraphs shall proceed as the lawyer reasonably believes necessary to assure that the organization's highest authority is informed of the lawyer's discharge or withdrawal. F. In dealing with the organization's directors, officers, employees, members, shareholders, or other constituents, a lawyer shall explain the identity of the client when the lawyer knows or reasonably should know that the organization's interests are adverse to those of the constituents whom the lawyer is dealing. And then finally, a lawyer representing an organization may also represent any of its directors, officers, employees, members, shareholders, or other constituents subject to the provisions of Rule 1.7 if the organization's consent to the dual representation is required by Rule 1.7. The consent shall be given by an appropriate official of their organization other than the individual who is to be represented or by the shareholders. Before we get into the next rule, I just want to provide Esquire CLE's second verification code. Please take note and pay attention now. Esquire CLE's second verification code is the word TRUE. T-R-U-E. TRUE. Esquire CLE's second verification code is the word TRUE. T-R-U-E. TRUE. Please take note of this code. You will need it to fill out the survey at the end. TRUE. T-R-U-E. Moving on to Rule 1.14, client with diminished capacity. When a client's capacity to make adequately considered decisions in connection with the representation is diminished, whether because of minority, mental impairment, or for some other reason, the lawyer shall, as far as reasonably possible, maintain a normal client relationship with the client. When the lawyer reasonably believes that the client has diminished capacity, is at risk of substantial physical, financial, or other harm unless action is taken, and cannot adequately act in the client's own interest, the lawyer may take reasonable and necessary protective action, including consulting with individuals or entities that have the ability to take action to protect the client, and in appropriate cases, seeking the appointment of a guardian ad litem, conservator, or guardian. Information relating to the representation of a client with a diminished capacity is protected by Rule 1.6. When taking protective action pursuant to paragraph B, the lawyer is impliedly authorized under Rule 1.6A to reveal information about the client, but only to the extent reasonably necessary to protect the client's interests. ABA Model Rule 2.1, Advisor. In representing a client, a lawyer shall exercise independent professional judgment and render candid advice in rendering advice. A lawyer shall may refer not only to law, but to other considerations such as moral, economic, social, and political factors that may be relevant to the client's situation. Rule 3.7, lawyer as witness. A lawyer shall not act as an advocate at a trial in which the lawyer is likely to be a necessary witness, unless the testimony relates to an uncontested issue, the testimony relates to the nature and value of legal services rendered in the case, or disqualification of the lawyer would work substantial hardship on the client. A lawyer may act as an advocate in the trial in which another lawyer in the lawyer's firm is likely to be called as witness unless precluded from doing so by Rule 1.7 or 1.9. And then the final rule is the Rule 5.4, professional independence of a lawyer, specifically Rule 5.4C, which states, a lawyer shall not permit a person who recommends, employs, or pays the lawyer to render legal services for another to direct or regulate the lawyer's professional judgment in rendering such legal services. With the case Phillips v. Carson, which is a Supreme Court of Kansas 1987 case. Here, the facts of the case are, in August 1980, Carson told Ms. Phillips that he was having a financial problem and Ms. Phillips loaned him $200,000. Carson told her that she would be fully secured and he gave her a note and secured a second mortgage on some Arizona property. These documents were properly executed and the mortgage was filed of record. In 1981, Phillips loaned Carson an additional $70,000. Because of his representation, she believed that this loan would get him over his current financial difficulties. She was concerned that he might harm himself and she thought this loan would increase the chances that her first loan would be repaid. Later, Carson asked Ms. Phillips to release her mortgage on the Arizona property so he could refinance and sell that or another property. He offered her a mortgage on 90 acres he owned in another county and told Mrs. Phillips that this would put her in a better position. She relied upon Carson's statements that he would be better secured and she trusted his advice as her attorney. On March 29, 1982, Mrs. Phillips released her mortgage on the Arizona property and Carson gave her a promissory note for $274,933.70, which included past due interest as principal. Carson also prepared executed a mortgage on the county property to Mrs. Phillips, but he failed to file that mortgage with the Register of Deeds. Carson at no time advised Mrs. Phillips to seek independent counsel regarding the loan transactions, and she did not discuss them with other partners of the Carson firm or with other counsel. In May 1982, Mrs. Phillips called Carson's office and learned that her mortgage had not been filed of record. She sought independent counsel who secured the mortgage and filed it for record on June 23, 1982. Mrs. Phillips then demanded payment in full from Carson. It was not forthcoming. On September 10, 1982, Carson filed a Chapter 11 petition in the United States Bankruptcy Court. What happened here is the attorney at no time advised the client to seek independent counsel regarding loan transactions between himself and his client. And at the time, an existing attorney-client relationship was in place, that the relationship gave rise to the duty on the attorney to properly, competently, and adequately counsel, advise, and represent the client, and that duty was breached. So the rule is that an attorney may not enter into a business transaction with a client in which his interests are adverse to his client if the client expects his attorney to exercise his professional judgment for the client's protection unless the client consents after full disclosure. We also have AAA Plumbing Pottery Corporation v. St. Paul Insurance Corporation of Illinois. This United States District Court of Northern District of Illinois 1995 case. So what happened here? In two workers' compensation actions brought by AAA, the plaintiff, employee Britton St. Paul, the defendant, defended the actions on part of AAA. Britton's attorney proposed settling all Britton's claims. St. Paul rejected the offer, but AAA claimed that St. Paul never communicated the offer to AAA. Britton brought a civil action for fraud against AAA despite advisement by counsel, the firm, and the SF&D to offer $100,000 to $125,000 to settle AAA, offered only $50,000, which Britton rejected. A jury awarded Britton $1.3 million in compensatory damages and $2 million in punitive damages. AAA filed for a motion notwithstanding the verdict for a new trial. SF&D also advised AAA to convey mortgages to affiliated corporations to protect them from attachment. Britton's attorney moved to set aside the mortgages as fraudulent conveyances. Before the post-trial motions were decided, AAA settled with Britton for $950,000. AAA sued St. Paul for bad faith and failing to communicate the settlement offers. St. Paul counterclaimed seeking declaration. It did not engage in bad faith and had no obligation to identify AAA. St. Paul notified AAA of its intent to call Gross, AAA's senior attorney, as a witness in the case. St. Paul moved for a protective order to disqualify Gross from representing AAA. So the issue here is, if an attorney knows or reasonably should know that he may be called as a witness other than on behalf of a client, may the attorney act as an advocate in the proceeding? And what the court said was yes. If an attorney knows or reasonably should know that he may be called as witness other than on behalf of the client, the attorney may act as an advocate in the proceeding unless the attorney knows or reasonably should know that his testimony is or may be prejudicial to the client. The court has discretion in determining whether an attorney may appear as a witness without withdrawing as an advocate in the action. The court may prevent the attorney from being called as a witness if the evidence is readily available from other sources and the absence of an extraordinary circumstances or compelling reasons. So those cases involve conflicts of interest between lawyers, clients, and third parties. And what we're going to conclude with are conflicts of interest between two clients. And the model rules discussed here, 1.7, 1.8, 1.9, 1.12, 1.8, and 6.3. And there's a few cases that I just wanted to highlight here before we wrap up. The first one is State Farm Mutual Automobile Insurance Company v. KAW. This is a Supreme Court of Florida case, 1991. And let's just get into the case here. David Wilkerson was driving a rental car in which his wife and infant daughter were passengers when he was struck by another car. The Wilkersons retained the law firm of Sheldon J. Schlesinger, PA, Schlesinger Firm, and filed suit against the driver and owner of other vehicles, the owner of the other vehicle and others for injuries suffered by the three of them in the accident. The action included a count against petitioner State Farm Mutual Automobile Insurance Company, State Farm, the Wilkerson's insurer for uninsured motorist coverage. The Wilkerson's also filed a separate malpractice action against various health care providers for allegedly negligent treatment of their daughter after the accident. The Schlesinger firm represented the Wilkerson's in the malpractice action. After the personal injury action had proceeded for approximately 1 year, the Wilkersons added new defendants, including petitioners Interstate Fire and Casualty Company and Continental Casualty Company, which had issued uninsured motorist insurance to Wilkerson's employer. The following year, the Wilkerson's attorney determined that David Wilkerson's negligence may have contributed to the automobile accident. Thereupon, Mr. Wilkerson discharged the Schlesinger firm as his counsel in the personal injury action and retained a former member of the Schlesinger firm as a new counsel. Shortly thereafter, Mrs. Wilkerson and her daughter filed a Second Amendment complaint in that action, adding David Wilkerson as defendant. The Schlesinger firm continued to represent Mrs. Wilkerson and their daughter in that action, and Mr. Wilkerson contested to be sued up to the limits of his insurance coverage. The firm also continued to represent all three Wilkersons in the medical malpractice action, asserting their exposure as liability insurers of Mr. Wilkerson. Each of the petitioners filed motions seeking the disqualification of the Schlesinger firm in the personal injury action. Petitioners objected to the potential for the Schlesinger firm to use confidential information gained during the course of the prior representation of Ms. Wilkerson in the case against him. In opposition to the motion, David Wilkerson filed an affidavit stating that he did not consider anything to be discussed with the Sheldon Schlesinger privilege because he had disclosed everything in his deposition, and he did not feel that Mr. Schlesinger's representation of his wife and daughter disadvantaged him in any way. Ms. Wilkerson also submitted an affidavit in which she stated that she and her daughter would be prejudiced if the Schlesinger firm were required to withdraw. The trial court refused to disqualify the Schlesinger firm, finding that the petitioners lacked standing to request disqualification in the face of Mr. Wilkerson. Mr. Wilkerson's contest to the firm representations of his wife and child. In addition, the court found that petitioners failed to show clearly and convincingly that they would be prejudiced or that the continued representation would interfere with the fair and impartial administration of justice. The Fourth District Court of Appeals denied the insurer's petitions for a writ of certiorari, finding no proof of substantial prejudice or circumstances calling into question the fair and efficient administration of justice. While not addressed by the majority opinion below, we shall first discuss the questions of the petitioner's standings. The Wilkersons contend that an attorney may not be disqualified where the former client has contested to the representation. The rule urged by the Wilkersons is based on the premise that rules governing attorney conduct are intended for the protection of the client who may either implicitly or explicitly waive the protection on the other hand. The petitioners argue that they have standing because, as insurance companies, they will be liable for payments of any judgment against David Wilkerson in this action. The ethical principle at issue is an attorney's duty to maintain the confidence of his client. That principle is embodied in two rules of professional conduct. The rules regulating the Florida Bar 4.4-1.6a provides that a lawyer shall not reveal information relating to representation of a client unless the client consents after disclosure to the client. The duty of confidentiality continues after termination of the attorney-client relationship. Rules regulating the Florida Bar 4-1.9 provides a lawyer who has formally represented a client in a matter shall not thereafter represent another person in the same or substantially related matter in which the person's interests are materially adverse to the interests of the former client unless the former client consents after the consultation or use information relating to the representation to the disadvantage of the former client except as Rule 4.4-1.6 would permit with respect to a client or with the information that has become generally known. The purpose of the requirement that an attorney maintain client confidence is twofold. It advances the interests of the clients by encouraging a free flow of information and the development of trust essential to an attorney-client relationship. However, it also serves as a second purpose fundamental to a fair adversary system. Our legal system cannot function fairly or effectively if an attorney has an informational advantage in the form of confidence gained during a former representation of a client's current opponent. The question then is whether the insurers may stand in the shoes of their insurer for purposes of seeking disqualification of the Schlesinger firm on grounds of conflict of interest. Comments to the rules of professional conduct indicate that under certain circumstances, someone other than the client may request disqualification. Thus, where a conflict is such as clearly to call into question the fair and efficient administration of justice, opposing counsel may properly raise questions. We find that the facts of this case call into question the fair administration of justice. Mr. Wilkerson is not exposed to any personal liability because he may be sued only up to the amount of any available insurance coverage. This, in reality, is not an action between Mr. Wilkerson and his child, but an action by the mother and child against the parents' insurance carriers. Mr. Wilkerson is in a position adverse to his daughters in theory only. He reasonably hopes to enhance his daughter's chance of recovery. The petitioners, on the other hand, will be acting in Mr. Wilkerson's defense, attempting to persuade the fact finder that he was not negligent in the automobile accident in order that they may avoid liability. Because of this situation, Wilkerson's consent to the firm's representation of the wife and daughter does not end the inquiry. Information disclosed by Mr. Wilkerson to his attorneys during the course of the attorney-client relationship could be used to prove that Mr. Wilkerson was negligent. This is adverse to the petitioners who are obligated to act in his defense. The unfairness and the situation resulted from the fact that Mr. Wilkerson and her daughter have a potentially informational advantage over those who must defend Mr. Wilkerson, who was gained as a result of the law firm's former representation of Mr. Wilkerson in his action. And it defies logic to suggest that the petitioners do not have a legitimate interest in seeking to prevent the opposing parties from using confidential information obtained from their insured through the prior attorney-client relationship. We conclude that the petitioners have standing to request the firm's disqualifications. We next address the issues of appropriation standards to apply to determine whether a Schlesinger firm should be disqualified. In conflict of interest cases such as this arising under the former Code of Professional Responsibility, one seeking to disqualify an opposing counsel was required to show that, one, an attorney-client relationship existed, thereby giving rise to an irrefutable presumption that the confidences were disclosed during the relationship, and two, the matter in which the law firm subsequently representing the interests adverse to the former client was the same or substantially related to the matter in which it represented the former client. This standard was based on the Code of Professional Responsibility, Canon 4, which provided that attorneys should preserve the confidences and secrets of a client. The rules of professional conduct requiring confidentiality serve the same purposes as the confidentiality requirements of the Code of Professional Responsibility. Similarly, the need for the irrefutable presumption continues to exist, such as under the former code. The presumption acknowledges the difficulties of proving that confidentiality information useful to the attorney's current client was given to the attorney. It also protects the client by not requiring disclosure of confidence previously given to the attorney. If two actions are substantially related, Court will not require proof the attorney had access to confidential information, nor give weight to the attorney's assertion that he had no access to it and did not possess confidential information. Accordingly, we disagree with the court below that actual proof of prejudice is a prerequisite to disqualification under those circumstances. The Schlesinger firm represented Mr. Wilkins in the personal injury action for more than 2 years, and the existence of this relationship raised the irrefutable presumption that confidences were disclosed. Moreover, the firm continued to represent Mr. Wilkinson in the medical malpractice action. Under Florida law, Mr. Wilkinson could be found liable in the instant case not only for those injuries which were sustained by his daughter in the automobile accident, but also for any injuries she received as a result of any subsequent medical practice. Thus, even now, Mr. Wilkinson may be disclosing confidences to the Schlesinger firm as his counsel in the medical malpractice action, which could be used against him by the Schlesinger firm in the instant case. In reaching our decision, we do not imply any misconduct on the part of the Schlesinger firm. In this respect, we find the statement in Rotainton v. Lawrence Hospital apropos. While these facts neither indicate nor imply any departure from the professional conduct or breach of any ethical canon, we cannot escape the conclusion that this is a situation rife with the possibility of discredit to the bar and to the administration of justice. Obviously, Mr. Turkowitz cannot erase from his mind the confidence he received from his former client or the plan of defense he envisaged. Though we do not dispute his good faith or the good faith of his firm representing plaintiff, both the possibility of conflicts of interest and the appearance of it are too strong to ignore. We quash the decision below and direct that the Schlesinger firm be disqualified from further representation of Ms. Wilkerson's and her minor child in this action. It is so ordered. We have a final case, and I see that we're running out of time, so I'll briefly just go over what it discusses. It's Häagen-Dazs Corporation v. Perche No Gelato Inc. and Double Rainbow Gourmet Ice Cream. And basically what this state says, that a lawyer who formally represented a client in a matter cannot represent another person in the same or substantially related matter if the factual context and the two representations are similar or related, regardless of whether the confidences were imparted. The attorney, to avoid even the appearance of impropriety, must be disqualified, unless obviously the client consents. So that concludes our program. Thank you so much for going all through this to the end with us. That was legal ethical concerns and case law. Be sure to fill out the survey underneath this program to receive your credit. Thank you so much.